From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at the start of the modern human era. We're talking about an era when human activity started to have a broad impact on our planet, other animals, ecosystems, climate. Our human brains are wired to think about time in a way that comports with our own experience. We think about 25 years being long-term. But if you want to think about the human impact in the modern era, one way to define it might be to go back 14,000 years, when humans started wiping out woolly mammoths and large mammals that were once commonly roaming. You see, when we think of time in such small frames, we might miss the big picture. And the big picture warns us that we might be in the middle of a mass extinction right now, and eventually the human race could fall victim to that chain of losses. Fred Gutierrez is the executive editor of Scientific American. His book covers all the ways the human race is really fostering potentially our own demise. It's a grim but important book called The Fate of Our Species, Why the Human Race May Cause Its Own Extinction and How We Can Stop It. He's a graduate of the University of Rochester, in town to give a presentation this evening. But first, my guest for the hour on Connections. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being back in Rochester.
Yeah, no, it's good to be back to the old stomping grounds and the old alma mater.
Well, Fred is going to give a presentation tonight, 7 p.m. tonight at Rush Reese Library. It is free, and you can attend. He'll be introduced by the great Adam Frank, who's going to be on this program in a couple of weeks, also talking about extinction of our species. We're talking about such happy things, Fred. Though when you meet Fred, you're actually quite a pleasant person.
Well, I think I'm kind of an optimistic person.
I know. You said so in the book.
Optimism is kind of a personality flaw, I guess.
Well, here's the thing that I think is actually in a very grim but very very serious way important. You write in the book that you are taking worst case scenarios. This is not a sugar-coated look at what might happen. It's not a look at what is definitely going to happen, which is a happy part of the book, but it is sort of a warning. None of what you write about is imminent, right? I mean, part of the point is to think out loud about what could happen and maybe think about heading it off, right?
Well, I mean, we don't know what's imminent, you know, and one of the things that that I try to focus on in this book is the notion that that things can happen more quickly than we think. Like, for example, climate change. People talk about this in time frames of the end of the century or by 2050.
Right.
In fact, you can have events that occur on shorter time scales. We just don't, these things are just very unpredictable, but they're possible. And so, what I wanted to do was sort of, at least with climate change, was to show that it's not necessarily a can that we can kick way down the road. It's, there actually could be pretty serious consequences in a relatively short time scale, like a year, as short as a year. From one of my sources, according to some of the research that he had done.
But here's part of my concern in reading your book. Whether you're talking about machines, artificial intelligence, or you're talking about bioterrorism, superbugs, those kind of things, or if you're talking about climate change, the collective will it's going to take to address them is, for me, a big concern. And here's an example. Let's just pick a sort of a arbitrary number. Let's say the United States decides we are going to cut fossil fuel emissions by 50% in a decade because it might hurt, but we have to do it. We don't know if other energies are going to be scalable enough to replace it in the short term, but we're going to do it anyway. It's the right thing to do. I'm worried that China and India would say, see us suckers, and laugh at us, as opposed to saying, hey, there's leading by example. This is something that has to happen. You know, same kind of thing with artificial intelligence. If we were able to say, whether it's as a country or companies, we're going to slow down. Technology can be wonderful, but we're going to make sure that we are doing our best to prevent any kind of super intelligent machine that may compromise our own existence. Isn't it a concern that others may say, well, hey, there's an open door. I'm going to blow through it while they dither. That's sort of my concern.
Well, yeah, I mean, the genie's out of the bottle in a sense, we're talking about, as you point out, we're talking about widely different kinds of things.
Sure.
You talk about climate. Climate is a very different subject than the internet. But when you talk about climate, the timescale we're talking about is can be very long. You know, I'm getting off the track here. What was your question again?
I'm concerned that we're not going to be able to collectively get things done to head this stuff off, because if
right.
one country decides to take a step back, other countries might not necessarily follow. They might view it as a weakness, as opposed to saying, "Hey, we
right.
all need to do this."
Well, in climate change, you know, nothing is going to happen unless something happens. So, if the United States doesn't take a leadership role, and other developing nations don't take a leadership role, you can't expect developing countries to take a leadership role, because they're following along in this.
Sure.
But I think that even if we stopped emitting carbon now completely, you know, we're talking about a 40-year timescale, a buildup of carbon in the atmosphere. So you would have consequences of that anyway. So it's a very difficult problem, and I don't, you know, I think with climate change, I don't think there's, you know, I don't think there's a chance that someone would, you know, that something bad would happen if we took action. You know, I think that, you know, something bad is definitely going to happen if we don't take action.
That's a fair point.
Now with artificial intelligence, it's you know, it's a technology that's out there, and you know once you have knowledge, it's very hard to unlearn something.
Yes.
You know, we're developing this technology to do a lot of things that we think are really good to do. For example, you know, we send Mars rovers to Mars, and they operate autonomously, and they make all sorts of decisions. And this involves really advanced technology and really advanced software. We could, so putting a brake on that would be a very difficult thing to do. You know, it wouldn't do much good, because you really can't, nobody can control all the research that's being done on this stuff. So you could cancel NASA's Mars program, but you couldn't stop researchers in Europe from doing work on this, you know. So it's not putting the genie back in the bottle is not something that really we're going to be able to do.
So partially, I guess part of the point then is to say, we're not going to roll it back or stop it, but we need to be having more of a public conversation about the consequences. And
I think
maybe
we do. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Part of my motivation for writing the book was, you know, to try to really very clearly spell out what some of the dangers, the risks that we've created from our success as a species. So, you know, we're wildly successful. We've populated the planet with 7 billion people, which is still heading upwards. And that's a big operation. I mean, that you have to keep that many people fed, and to keep that many people with power, and to keep that many people in a state of political stability. You know, it's a big operation. So in order to do that, technologically, we've put our money on a lot of technology that we need. We need power. We need to control disease outbreaks that could happen over this new world that we've created. We've created a different environment for bugs. We've tapped fossil fuels, which is a technology, and has given us the energy that we need to build this credible global civilization. But that now that's also coming back to bite us in the form of climate change. So, you know, that's really just to look at what where the human enterprise is, and figure out, you know, what risks we've undertaken, and then with the idea that once we identify them, once we understand those, that we can start to talk about how to maybe mitigate those risks.
Talking to Fred Gutero, who is the author of a book about the potential extinction of our species and how to head it off. It's called The Fate of Our Species, Why the Human Race May Cause Its Own Extinction and How We Can Stop It. You can see him tonight, 7 p.m. at the Rush Reese Library. It is free through the University of Rochester. And if you want to call the program and brighten our day, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. It seems almost certain that before the Earth is gone, the human race will be gone from the Earth. Probably, right? I mean, That's a long time.
Well, you know, the Earth is going to be around here for a really long time.
That's what I'm saying. It's a long time. So yeah. The likelihood that we're still, probably not, right?
When the sun explodes, that we're still out somewhere.
Sure.
I mean, you've got to give that long odds, yeah.
Yeah, right. So Fred reminds us in the book that there is really two ways that our extinction will happen. It may be an event that you really can't control, a 9-mile-wide asteroid similar to the one that wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. And it may be one that we have more control over but fail to control, whether it is artificial intelligence or some other cause, et cetera. You have a guess now? Any idea why you think it's going to happen?
I really don't want to guess. I mean, you know,
you
haven't really
done the math on what's the most likely?
Well, you know, you can do the math on the likelihood of an asteroid impact. You know, I'd have to say, though, that just off the top of my head, you know, I mean, I think the things that we're doing are really the clear and present danger, you know.
Wouldn't you, though, if you were running NASA, maybe double their budget, but tell them 50% on near-Earth objects?
I think that would be a very prudent investment, yeah. The amount NASA spends on the asteroid watch program, such as it is minuscule. It's a few million dollars, you know, when you think about... You know, when you think maybe it's a low likelihood, high impact event, and you know it's probably a good idea to spend a little bit more to do that, to bond, you know, to get ready to send Bruce Willis up there in case something actually starts coming toward us. You know, I don't discuss that much in the book, but you know, because those are acts of nature that really we don't have that much control over, you know. I like the idea, you know, this idea that, I mean, there's a lot of moralizing and you know, chest beating about things like climate and population and that. And I think, I think what the idea that really interested me was the idea that, we're putting ourselves we're by our own success we're putting ourselves in this position where we then have to start to think about the scale of our own success and what that means. So you know, it's like if you think of if you think of bugs in a petri dish, you know, and you put a little drop in and there's plenty of food, and then they start to grow and they multiply and their numbers go up dramatically, and then they reach the edges of the dish and they run out of food. And, you know, I'm not saying that we're, I don't want to be a doomsayer here. I don't want to say that we're about to run to the edge of our dish, but there are signs that there are, you know, that we have things to worry about, and climate, food, you know, things like that, resources, the way we use energy. These are all very fundamental things. It's new in our thinking. I mean, it's new in the thinking of when you think about us as a civilization, humans as a civilization. We've never had to think about this kind of thing before. It reminds me, I remember I was, I took my kids about a few years ago out to the Pacific Northwest, and we were talking to one of the rangers out in one of the old growth forests, and she was telling us that 100 years ago, settlers came out there and started cutting down trees, and the thinking was that this was an inexhaustible resource. There was so much forest out there that you couldn't possibly cut down trees fast enough to have it, to make a dent in it. And it struck me that only 100 years ago, now we know that this is completely untrue, that, you know, deforestation is a huge global problem. It struck me that that was only 100 years ago. I mean, 100 years is a very short amount of time.
Nothing.
And now, you know, my kids who are, well, they're actually off to college now. They're having to, they are in a very different world than I grew up in, and I was in a very different world than my grandfather grew up in, and they're really facing these problems of coming up against the edges of the petri dish, and it's a fundamentally different attitude toward our environment, our planet.
Before I get to our first caller, Rich, who disagrees with the idea that we'll cause our own extinction. Before I get to Rich, let me say that, and I don't mean to pick on an easy target, but here's something that I've heard from Rush Limbaugh. We talk about fossil fuel consumption. Mr. Limbaugh has said, the greatest thing about humans is innovation, that when we meet a crisis, when we enter a crisis, that's when we innovate the best, that we're all concerned about picking winners and losers as the future of alternative energy, but when we truly exhaust fossil fuels, we will figure it out because that's what we've always done. My concern in reading Fred's book, which, by the way, for our listeners, is tremendously accessible. My concern is that there are going to be crises that we can't simply say, hey, when something bad happens, then we'll figure it out. Your book reminds us that if you always rely on innovation once crisis hits, you will eventually meet a crisis that it is too late to innovate out.
See, well, this is the flaw. The flaw in that reasoning is that just because things have happened a certain way in the past doesn't mean they're going to happen that way in the future. When you put your money in a mutual fund, you always get that language, you know, past performance is no guide to future returns. And the great thing about that is that no one believes that, and no one, you know, really. I mean, you look at the past performance, you think, wow, this has done really well. It'll probably do well in the future. That's human nature. If you're smart, you'll think, well, you know, pork bellies are probably going to drop or for some reason or other. But the point is it's human nature to think that tomorrow is going to be like today. And so just because we've always, you know, in the past, we've run up against these problems and we've found solutions and we've made our way, we've somehow done it, it's always worked out in the past, doesn't mean it's going to work out in the future. I argue that there are reasons why it may not work out in the future. And if I can just tell you about a conversation I had with an ecologist. I know we want to get to a question, but...
No, that's okay.
I had a conversation with an ecologist about this, and she was saying, you know, she does population, quantitative population studies and modeling. And she said, you know, if you objectively looked at the growth curve of the human population, and objectively I meant like if it didn't say humans, if it said bacteria, you would say, well, and you had to predict what the future was going to be for this population after this precipitous growth, you'd have to say that this population is probably headed for a crash. And, you know, when you think about what a population crash is in human terms, that's a very chilling concept. And this, you know, this is what the perspective of scientists can bring to this. You know, the great thing about science and one of the things I really love about it is that it can force you to see reality that your human nature doesn't allow you to see.
Fred's book is called The Fate of the Species. And once in a while, you hear the host on this program say, you should read it. You should read this book. I said the same thing about James Barrett's book last year called Our Final Invention, which is about artificial intelligence. There are certain things I think we really do need to be keying in on. Fred hits artificial intelligence as one of many factors in the book.
You're very kind. I appreciate the kind words.
Well, I mean, I think these kind of things, even if the possibilities are small, if they are non-zero, we ought to be dealing with them in a very, very serious way. We're talking about the future of our species, for goodness sake. Let me get Rich in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, I heard you say that I disagree with him as an extinction, as us wiping ourselves out, and I can't disagree with him any more than I do. For the simple reason that in all your models and when you're talking about animals and all that, you're talking about most of the time, when a species goes extinct, it's usually pretty much on a local scale. Very few species that are on a global scale is ever going extinct unless we, man, has destroyed the species. That's number one. Number two, global warming, I think it's going to be catastrophic. It's going to make change. But global warming does not destroy humanity. It makes absolutely great changes in how we live and where we live. And all of those things. And each one of these things you're talking about, will they affect us? Yeah, but extinction, I think the author is a doomsayer, and I think he's not, I think logically he's really not looking at it. Even on the ecological scale, you can't look at it. Most ecology that you're speaking of is not speaking on a worldwide level. And the human being is the only species that lives on the entire Earth at every spot. All those other outside of bacteria and stuff. And if you look at any species that has been worldwide, Earth-wide, they have not gone extinct unless it was something catastrophic like the asteroid. So him speaking about us causing our own extinction is hyperbole at best.
Okay. Rich, thanks for the call. Fred?
Well, thanks, Rich. That's actually a really good point. You know, I think extinction is a really high bar. You're right. I think it's very it's a lot easier to argue for catastrophe than it is to argue for extinction
and widespread suffering, et cetera. Yeah,
yeah, right. Because you know, extinction is, you know, extinction means every last person. You know, and you know, yeah, that's less likely than catastrophe. You're right. I think, you know, but I don't. I think it's more likely than it was 100 years ago. And I think the reason is because we are doing so many things that are sort of tempting fate on a global scale. You know, climate change is global. You know, it's not a local phenomenon. The environment for a very transmissible pathogen like influenza virus is a global environment. You know, it's very connected. You know, a flu bug can go from one end of the earth to the other in very short order. So you know, I take your point that extinction is tough. You know, it's tough to get to. You have to have a lot of catastrophes happening at the same time, but you know, but I'm not saying any of this is, none of this is a prediction. It's just a discussing the possibilities and the risks.
Right. And let me also clarify again, Fred's the guy I would hire for my company to say, tell me what's the worst thing that could happen. That's a lot of the thought experiments in the book are saying, we're going to look at the worst possible scenario. But worst possible scenario still includes the word possible. And I think the book does that in a way that isn't shrill, that isn't sort of cartoonish. And for me, that's why I feel like it's a must read. I feel like I read the book and I wasn't finding myself down in the dumps about the human race. But here's Jake's comment that I think I tend to agree with. Jake writes, the scope of this book seems to focus on geological timescales, which is hard enough for people to understand. What does Fred think about cosmological timescales? Inevitably, the human race as we know it will cease to exist either through extinction or through evolutionary progression. Stagnation, meaning the human race as we know it existing in, say, a million years, is simply not an option. That's what Jake writes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. If you want to go out millions of years, then you know, assuming we survive the next 100, you know, there are a lot of possibilities, and one of the possibilities is evolution, and one of the or self-directed evolution. I mean, you know, people have written about you know, how we could change ourselves so that we could survive interstellar travel, or perhaps we could even live in the vacuum of space if we had, you know, I don't know, big ears that collected solar radiation. You know, I'm just making that up, but you know, but you can argue that, you know, there are all sorts of possibilities about leaving the Earth behind and going out there. But I stay pretty much really in the relatively near future. I mean, the kind of stuff that I'm talking about is really really the next few decades or the next century, you know. Now, having said that, people talk about the Anthropocene period being the period of human, you know, a geological period that's characterized by human existence on a large scale. And you know, and there's been a lot of debate recently about when that actually starts and does it start now? Did it start a few thousand years ago? I mean, I argue, I don't particularly care when you call it starts, but I argue that, you know, you can argue that 14,000 years or so ago, when human hunting and this is pretty much confirmed, contributed to the extinction of a lot of the large mammals that populated in North America, Canada. That was really probably around the time where human populations got big enough to have a pretty big impact on the planet. And you know, we've only had more and more of an impact since, and you know, we're causing a lot of a species extinction. And if you go back, if you compare that time scale, so that's been 14,000 years already, and then if you go back and you look at mass extinctions that have occurred in the past, and they're generally thought of as being taking millions of years to happen. But there is some research that could possibly just be because the fossil record is so rough, you know. So you go back in the fossil record, you go, somewhere around this million or two or 10 million years, species went extinct. But it's possible there's some research that shows that that these extinction events may have been pretty quick. And the obvious one is the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs. But there have been others where there's just been a great oxidation event where, you know, you had bacteria, most of the bacteria on the planet, and the planet was largely bacteria, most of the bacteria on the planet were anaerobic, meaning they didn't use oxygen. And then there were the growth of algae, which did use oxygen, and you know, one pushed the other out, and that was really an atmospheric change by changing the chemistry that these organisms used to live changed the atmosphere of the planet and causing one species to virtually go extinct, or one type of bacteria to virtually go extinct. So it's like a long-winded way of saying that, you know, the geologic timescales, you know, are not necessarily outside the realm of our experience that we talk about when we talk about climate change and these other things that are happening.
But boy, do we not do a very good job of thinking about time. Your book reminds me of that. I mean, when, for example, yes, the meteor 9 miles wide that wiped out the dinosaurs was an event, but there are other extinction events that, as you write, happened, quote unquote, very quickly, maybe over 10,000 years. That's pretty quick.
Yes,
exactly. That's actually quick, and we are not equipped to think of that as quick at all.
Right, and you could argue that we've already been doing it for 14,000 years.
Right, and that's the concern I have, is that even though Fred's book does make us think of maybe the next few decades or even 100 or 200 years, if we are not kind of seeing time in a little bit broader lens, then I fear we are going to be very surprised by certain developments, because if 10,000 years is a quick extinction event, we're not really seeing the big picture. Fair?
Yeah, no, we're not very good generally at seeing the big picture. I mean, like I say, we tend to be optimistic creatures. I mean, you know, we go through our daily lives not really believing that we're ever going to die, and yet we all know that we are going to die eventually. And you know, we think that one day is, you know, that tomorrow is going to be a lot like today, and when in fact things are always changing. Yeah, I agree.
Well, let's get to a 60-second break. The phones have lit up. We're going to get to your phone calls next. And if you want to see Fred tonight, he is at the Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester, 7 p.m. tonight, and it's free. He's talking about the fate of the species, why the human race may cause its own extinction, and how we can stop it. Your phone calls with Fred next. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Bernard in Fairport, you're next. Go ahead, Bernard.
Yeah, thank you. I guess I'm a little concerned about the previous discussion about, well, we're not going to be extinct, so therefore you're wrong. I mean, there's a degree of how do you define a disaster, I guess, is, you know, and if the whole world isn't going to be extinct, then we don't really have to worry about global warming. I mean, let's face it, you know, India, China, these people are polluting the weather or polluting the climate very, very badly. I mean, the death rate in China is going up because of pollution. So to me, you don't distract from the problem by saying, well, we're not all going to be extinct, and when we get to be a big problem, we'll solve the problem. That is ridiculous thinking and conversation. You need to fix this thing or think about this thing in increments, not in the final, you know, okay, maybe the world won't be destroyed. But, for example, there's a village in Alaska with 400 residents that are going to have to move out because the sea is coming up. Now, maybe ExxonMobil will say, well, that's not a problem. We can get around that. But there is, you know, you don't have to have extinction in order to have a serious problem that you have to deal with. It's possible, so it definitely requires some thinking. But I don't really want Bangladesh to disappear. I don't want all the Chinese to die from lung disease. So let's start thinking about the world and, you know, incrementally making it better, not solving the problem. Thanks very much.
Bernard, I think that's beautifully said. Fred, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that is well said. I mean, you know, putting extinction aside, a population crash chills me, that prospect. And, you know, I think I like your idea of increments, you know. I mean, because, you know, we tend to hope for big solutions, and they don't materialize, and maybe sometimes small ones would a lot of small ones would be better. I was at the science conference last week, and I ran into Paul Ehrlich, who's the Stanford professor and you know, population guy. And, you know, I asked him, you know, when I was researching my book, he had done a back of the envelope calculation that the carrying capacity of the world, of the planet for humans was a sustainable carrying capacity was about 2 billion people. And so we're 5 billion over that now.
And still
and,
rising
and climbing.
Fast, yes.
Exactly. So let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that we need that eventually the human race is going to get to about 2 billion. That's the steady state. That's where, you know, you get a rise and then a fall and a rise and a fall, and then we even out at 2 billion. I really want to go from 7 or 9 or 10 billion down to 2 billion gradually. That is what we want to do.
Yeah,
you know? If that indeed is the number,
and what an important question. And every time this comes up, in my own mind, I think of the most sort of maybe this is silly, Fred, but I always think, you know, I don't know if China is wrong about population control. I don't know if we need to have more mature conversations about. Should you be able to have 19 kids? I don't know. I'm not saying I know the answer to that. I'm saying I'm open-minded to what are we going to do if the equilibrium population for this planet is 2 billion? And that's maybe that's wrong, but what if it's 4 billion? We still have to find a way to figure that out, and I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
Do you have an idea for
it? Yeah, I mean, I think China is not the country to emulate in terms of population
sure.
control because their one-child policy has really led to a lot of suffering. Which, you know, we don't really need to go into, and they're a different kind of a government than
I hope no listener takes that as the host endorsing that. I'm saying I'm open to evidence and
right.
we need to think.
But I think there's a pretty clear evidence that, the way to, control population, is to raise living standards and empower women. I would say that those are probably the two things, and maybe even empowering women may be number one on that, because you know when you empower women who actually bear children, you know you get a different dynamic. There's a big literature on this, that's a policy where you're talking about education, you're talking about reforming. You got to be careful when you use words like reform, but encouraging a more equitable forms of society in parts of the world where population is really growing quickly. I mean, Africa is the, when the UN revised their figures recently, I think maybe about a year ago, where they revised them upwards for the world population projections. They originally had them peaking at around 9 billion toward in the middle of the century, and they upped that to 10 or 12 billion at the end of the century. The change there was the trajectory of population in Africa, and you look at some of the figures for individual countries in Africa, and the projections are huge. So I think if you can this is where we're all in the same boat together. Mm-hmm. Americans don't really generally tend to ignore Africa. They don't really, we don't pay that much attention to it. We should, because in the same way we should pay attention to the less fortunate people in our own country, because when it comes to the overall health of a society, we're all in it together, and the health and the welfare of the least prosperous affects the health and welfare of everyone.
So in other words, if we think we are urgent about women's rights and equality, get more urgent.
Yeah, no, I think that's, these are a bunch of studies done. I can't cite them to you, but it's pretty well established that as a policy prescription, empowering women in societies is usually solves a lot of problems.
When it comes to machines, and we could do an hour just on machines, and we have on this program before, but when people hear machines, whether it's nanotechnology, whether it's the intelligence of computers and their ability to think for themselves, but I think we all understand the point here. I want to see if I can remember where. I think I flagged. There was a passage in the book that struck me. See if I can find it here. Yes. Okay. So there's a phrase you've talked to a number of experts in this book, and in fact, it's beautifully researched, Fred, but really accessible. I'll say it again for our listeners. It's great storytelling. It's not hit you on the head academic.
Thank you.
It's really digestible. And here's a portion where someone is telling you about programs that would take control of industrial systems in order to do harm without anybody manually intervening, having in an old-fashioned way to be at the controls. It's already old-fashioned to have a human being in control of a machine. It's already old-fashioned.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you think of, one of the big stories of, at Scientific American, where I'm an editor, we are covering is the growth of autonomous machines, and it used to be called artificial intelligence, kind of still is now and then, but it's really the idea that machines can make very sophisticated decisions without human intervention. So I like to think of them as well. There's a particular bit of malware that allegedly the U.S. government invented called Stuxnet that went out and destroyed Iran's uranium centrifuges a few years ago, and the way they did this was they sat down and they thought about the target. They thought about what are the machines that that we're targeting here. They're centrifuges. They spin, right? They spin around, and they use a centrifugal force to separate uranium isotopes. And this is important for a nuclear weapons facility because you need highly enriched uranium for nuclear weapons. And they knew that Iran had these centrifuges. They actually knew that Iran was buying the computer chips that run these devices from various vendors. I think one of them was Siemens. I'm not sure if my memory is correct at that though. But it was the point is that they knew exactly which device they ran these things. Then they wrote a program that could insert it, that once inserted into that device. Would cause these centrifuges to self-destruct, but they would do it in a way that it would hide the destruction from the Iranians until it was too late to stop it. So it was incredibly sophisticated, something out of it's something out of a Mission Impossible, you know. But then they had to also write software around this little kernel of software that would deliver the software to these controllers. And the way they did that was they put it on thumb drives. And so they would pass out on these thumb drives, and you've gotten them. You go to a conference, and they say, "Oh yeah, here's a little USB drive, and all our information is in there." When they have this little program, Stuxnet, and then the Stuxnet would get onto a computer, and it would say, "Where am I? What computer am I on? What country am I in? How close have I gotten to Iran's centrifuges?" And then it would think, I'm not that close, and here's what I need to do, or I need to jump to somewhere else. And it would get on a network, and then it would jump somewhere, and it would install itself on another machine. And so it spread like this until it got into this facility. Now, this facility was not connected to the internet. It's not like somebody attacked a website. This facility was air-gapped, so there was no physical connection to
Iran
anything.
Iran just didn't accidentally leave their password out.
No.
Right.
So they eventually got this bug, this malware, on a thumb drive of some technician who stuck it into a into one of the slots on this Iranian nuclear program, and then it destroyed these centrifuges. So it's something out of Jason Bourne. The ability to go out without contact to the home base, to figure out where you are, to figure out how to get to where it is you're going, and then implement your mission. This is what a computer, it's a little tiny program. It's not very big. You wouldn't notice it on your hard drive. It's not like it takes up a lot of space, like it's some Microsoft thing or something. It was immensely clever. Now, this technology is probably, it was found out in 2010, I think. So it's at least 5 years old, probably more. Now, you've got to think that the technology's moved on since then. We've had these very high-profile cases of hacking where the North Koreans allegedly hacked Sony over the... this movie.
Sure, sure.
When you combine our reliance on the internet with the development of advanced autonomous machines, and I consider a bit of software is I consider a machine. You have the potential for a lot of mischief.
Well, and let me just say before I get back to the phones, real briefly. The point that I took out of the book is not that, well, we're getting better at hacking or we could shut down a centrifuge. It's that if you use your imagination to think about all the things we rely on machines for now, and the way these programs can be written, there are some very bad scenarios that could come about.
Yeah, one of the ones I talk about in the book is I ran into a guy, Scott Borg, who... right after 9/11, there had been a lot of research into something called value creation.
Yep.
So you buy computers and you install them on your company, and how much value have you created by doing that? So economists want to measure this, and so there's a whole bunch of theory. Well, he got the idea. He and others got the idea after 9/11 to look at value destruction. Like if you destroy something, how much havoc, economic havoc, do you wreak? Now, you think about our electrical grid and how a lot of it is connected to the internet, you know, because you've got these smart meters. And if you had a bit of malware that had Stuxnet-like capabilities that went around and installed itself on every power generator in the country, and then in a coordinated way caused all these power generators to destroy themselves, you could create a dire situation in the United States where you needed to replace, say if you had to replace half the country's power generators at once. These things, they're only made in a few places. It takes years to make them. It means we would go months or even a year without power for vast parts of the country. And Scott Borg did an investigation into how bad would this be, you know? And he found that the fatalities would be on the order of a nuclear holocaust. Lots of people would die. And it seems counterintuitive because, so the power goes out, you use candles for a while. But, during Hurricane Sandy, there were gas shortages. And there were gas shortages because there was no electricity to pump the gas out of the tanks underground. And so if you can imagine a situation over large parts of the country for a long time like this, you can imagine people not getting their medicine. You can imagine people not getting food shipments. You know, the grocery store shelves would run empty. The economy would collapse. It's just, it would be terrible. And this is a very real vulnerability. It's a shocking vulnerability. Really. And, I don't know that it's being addressed.
That last line's the scariest part. Let me get back to the phones. Keith, go ahead, Keith.
Evan, a couple comments. You had a caller earlier mentioned about extinction. Under the right situation, at any given time, we are one generation from extinction. If something were to evolve or change or on our own accord prevent us from reproducing, as a species, we would be screwed, for lack of a better word. We would only last one generation. We'd be over within about 100 years, 110 years. People still don't know what happened to the Mayan civilization, why they just sort of up and disappeared. That could have been they lost the ability to reproduce because of something they cultivated and ate. But the other comment about Rush Limbaugh and technology, the one thing, and again, I'll have the author correct me if I'm wrong, the first law of thermodynamics says you can't create matter, just change it. You can't create it or destroy it, just basically change it. And people don't understand it, that if you burn a billion tons of coal, you essentially create a little bit less than a billion tons of carbon dioxide. And people just can't fathom that. They can't understand that when you burn carbon, you create carbon dioxide. Granted, you got ash and you got other elements that get tossed in the air, but for easy definition, you just create the carbon dioxide. And how long have we been burning carbon-based fuels? A real long time. And it gets to the point where vegetation can't recycle the CO2 fast enough. And that poses another problem because when the vegetation eventually dies and rots, it just puts the carbon dioxide back in the air. And people just don't understand the basic biology of that. And I think if they did know that, they would realize as to what we're dumping in the air, and it just doesn't go away.
Keith, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. I mean, the fossil fuels are produced by organic matter. You know, things, plants die, and they many, many thousands of years, they get turned into oil or some kind of petrochemical, and we pump it up and we burn it, and it takes a long time for nature to go through that process to trap the carbon that's in these plants and bury it underground, and it takes us a very short amount of time to pump it up and burn it and release it back into the atmosphere. That's the problem in a nutshell. And, you know, it's why a lot of scientists and engineers are working on ideas of somehow capturing carbon in the atmosphere and pumping it back down, pumping it under geologic formations where it could, you know, it could stay bottled up for a long time. You know, none of these ideas are ready for prime time, and there are problems with all of them. But, you know, that's the idea.
And Fred, I only got about a minute left here, but any other solutions you want to leave with our audience, things to think about to some of these issues that feel intractable at times, but some solutions to think about?
Yeah, I mean, it's awfully gloomy, you know, but the thing that really has that sort of lifted my spirits when I was writing this was, and I hope I can convey this in the book itself, is the people the people who are working on this stuff, the people who are thinking about it. There are a lot of really smart people out there, and you know, I just have to be optimistic that we're gonna muddle through this. I would say that. You know, I think in order to muddle through it, I think we have to be open to solutions, even if they're technologic and scary sounding sometimes. You know, I think that we are a technological society. We have crossed that bridge, and there's really no going back.
Thank you for writing the book, and I say that honestly. I think these are important conversations. It's the fate of the species, why the human race may cause its own extinction, and how we can stop it. Fred's going to be speaking tonight, 7 p.m. at the Rush Reese Library. It's free. You could see him there. Important conversations, and we scratched the surface. Maybe you can, next time you're back in Rochester, we'll talk a little bit more.
Oh, I'm happy to.
Thank you.
Anytime.
And thanks for the optimism. I think the host was more pessimistic than the author. All right. Thanks for listening. Val, great job as always behind the board. And we'll talk to you on Thursday on member-supported public radio.